Good morning. Hawaii's primary is less than 3 weeks away. Today we'll look at some of the tight Maui races one longtime resident says are worth watching. Dick Mayer weighs in later this hour. For months, she's been critical of now GOP presidential nominee Donald Trump. We'll catch up with House Republican Beth Fukumoto Chang to get her assessment of her party and if she'll stay in it. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich.
And I'm Chris Vanderkirk. There's a convergence of theatrical talent underway at Chaminade, with performers, directors, and technical staff coming together for the Chaminade Collegiate Theater Festival. And Peter and Melinda Wing bring mythical and magical creatures to life in a Maui storytelling session.
That's the conversation for this Monday, July 25th. Stay here as it all starts. First, though, this news. Good morning and welcome to a Monday after a wet and wild weekend. We hope that you're safe and reasonably dry and things are okay with you and your family. Good morning, I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. Hi there, Chris Vanderkirk.
Good morning, Beth Ann. I'm old enough to remember when party conventions were displays of feel-good displays of party unity, and now both parties seem to be unraveling at their conventions.
Unraveling and splitting even deeper. And we've been talking about this now for a very long time, how that's playing out here locally. We're going to pick up that conversation this morning. Now, you know, for months, the fissures in the Republican Party have continued to split the GOP. And although the Stop Trump movement has itself been stopped, many in it are still wondering how to support a party whose nominee they can't support. That would seem to be the situation with State Representative Beth Fukumoto Chang. We've been speaking with her periodically to get her assessment of the GOP's future in Hawaii and her personal dislike of the party's now nominee for president, Donald Trump. Beth Fukumoto Chang joins us now by phone. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for making time for us.
Of course.
Now, well, you and I have been talking about this for a long time. You've been pretty vocal, and in all the conversations that we've had since last fall, you've been rather categorical that Donald Trump is not your candidate, and now, of course, he's the GOP nominee. How are you assessing your party now?
Well, my opinion hasn't changed. I don't think he has come around to show any of his earlier statements or earlier actions were different than what we expected. I still think he's exhibiting things that we shouldn't be valuing as a party.
Specifically, which ones?
I think, you know, if you watched his nomination speech, for one, this whole idea of sort of doom and destruction is just not what I think we should be presenting. Particularly, I think it casts minorities in a terrible light. And you know, the party seems to be sort of doubling down on picking up the votes of sort of white America, and I don't think that is a winning strategy moving forward.
As is expected after most conventions, the nominee gets a bounce. He certainly has gotten a bounce today, looking at the CNN poll, which has him a few points ahead of Hillary Clinton. That obviously may change, but as you look at that, how do you reconcile that with the fact that, you know, you're very different from the people that Donald Trump seems to be seeking to be able to get himself elected?
Yeah, I mean, I think at least my feeling, even as a Republican, is that Donald Trump and the path that he's taken, he doesn't need my vote. He doesn't necessarily want it. He's made no effort to try to pick it up. And that was my takeaway from the convention is okay, they're going to double down on this strategy. And those of us that don't fit into the picture of what they're trying to pick up as voters or who they're trying to pick up as voters are unnecessary. And as I said, I don't think that that's a winning strategy for the party, maybe for this election. But we know the demographics are changing in the country, and this is not something that can continue.
So, Beth Fukumoto Chang, how are you talking to your constituents now?
You know, I think, surprisingly, I think I agree with Ted Cruz, is people should just vote their conscience. And I do want them to support candidates up and down the ticket that fit whatever they believe. So I've always said people should split the ticket if they want to. Vote for Democrats, vote for Republicans, vote for the best candidate rather than looking only at the party label. And I think that's the same thing, and I hope people do that in my district, that they'll continue to be willing to consider a Republican if it's a Republican that fits their values.
A lot of people are saying that they find this so upsetting, whether they're a Democrat or a Republican, and certainly looking at what we're seeing play out before the Democratic convention today, that there are people who are just saying, I'm going to opt out, or, you know, I'm going to vote for a third party. Jill Stein is being looked at as, you know, some sort of, if not not sane, but certainly an option for a lot of people, which is to say that this election could be grossly distorted by people who simply want to opt out.
Right. And you know, voter apathy is such a difficult thing, particularly in our state. We already have a low voter turnout. So to see sort of what's unfolding nationally is just very sad from, you know, the perspective of an American. If everybody stays home and decides not to vote, you know, then both parties have really done a disservice to the American people, because I don't think either party has presented a nominee that really fits with what the American public wants. And people feel like they're voting for the less of two evils. And that's sad.
You talk about apathy, but, you know, clearly what we're seeing on both sides of the aisle, this is not apathy. This is a lot of conviction and passion on the part of both people who, you know, have been Democrats up to this point, but are very upset because of what has been happening with Debbie Wasserman Schultz and Bernie Sanders. Those who are in the GOP who are saying, as you are saying, Donald Trump is not my candidate. Vote your conscience, whatever it may be. But clearly watching these fissures deepen, how do you think that this is going to be able to go forward in the way that we've traditionally known American politics?
Yeah, well, I don't think it can. I don't think we can continue down this path. The polarizing nature of this particular election cycle, but this cycle leading up to it, we didn't get here overnight. The polarizing nature of that has basically alienated a lot of voters. And I think what we have is we do have a lot of voter apathy, not within the party. So people that are normally involved in parties or people that are very politically aware maybe latched onto a candidate, latched onto a party this cycle. But what we're getting are the people that are very angry one way or the other. And I think the vast majority of Americans don't feel that way. They feel frustrated, but they're not going to go protest in the streets. And I'm worried they're not going to come out to vote either.
How about you and your own personal frustration? I mean, there are rumors sort of circulating around that you may be in the GOP for now, but maybe not for long.
Yeah. You know, at the end of the day, I think both parties are having problems. And I think that's clear. I think neither party has delivered something that's going to benefit America. And I think all elected officials should be moving forward thinking twice about the choices that we have. Should we only be picking Republican and Democrat? I don't know. I think this particular election cycle, we might see a break in that, and we might see either centrists coming together or people that just sort of want to put parties aside. And I think we could see that in the next 10 years. So as I've sort of told everybody, I'm not going to say that I'm going to be in the Republican Party absolutely forever. I don't think that anybody in politics right now can or should be making that commitment.
Well, thank you very much for your candor, and we'll be watching what happens, and we'll talk to you soon.
Thank you.
State House Minority Leader Beth Fukumoto Chang is the youngest person to serve in that position. In 2013, the political blog The Daily Beast listed her as one of nine women remaking the right.
This is The Conversation on member-supported HPR2. It's 8:13, and coming up, a unique gathering of apprentice theater artists at Chaminade. But first, your quiz.
In today's backyard quiz, some good and bad guys. Every crime fighter needs a master villain against whom he can test his wits, and the more sinister that character, the better. Sherlock Holmes had his nemesis in Professor Moriarty, the Napoleon of crime. This morning, we're looking for the crime lord who matches wits with Steve McGarrett in the hit TV show Hawaii Five-0, both the old and the new editions. He first turned up in the original show's pilot program on September 20th, 1968, as a Chinese spy with a gift for prying information out of his prisoners. He reappeared on episodes including 40 Feet High and It Kills, A Bullet for McGarrett, and A Time to Die. McGarrett, who usually dispatches the bad guys with style, is never quite able to put this one away. He continues to bedevil the head of Hawaii's fictional state police force until the show's very last episode. Series producer Leonard Freeman named him after a popular Chinatown restaurant whose site is now on the National Register of Historic Places. That's the name we're looking for this morning. Call us at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. And the first one to get it right will get the HPRT.
Aloha, I'm Rosa Harrington from Manoa. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR2, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
It's an ideal bridge for young theater artists between the classroom and the professional stage. A theater festival that creates its own company and puts together three very different shows in a short span of time. The results of the work that has been done behind the scenes at the Chaminade University Collegiate Theater Festival are about to go before the public, and Kevin Berg, one of the festival's guest directors, is on hand to tell us more. Good morning, Kevin.
Good morning, Chris.
Tell me a little bit about this, how this festival works.
So the way that this festival works is that over the next 3 weeks, there's going to be three different shows from Thursday to Saturday. So mm-hmm. It's going to be Thursday, Friday, Saturday night for the next 3 weeks.
Each weekend devoted to a single show?
Yep. Each weekend gets a different show.
So what's yours?
My show is the musical Next to Normal.
Mm-hmm.
Then the next show that comes up after me is Almost Maine, which is kind of a... It's a winter spectacle in this summer heat. And then the third one is The Rose and the Rhyme, which is a theater for young audiences show.
Three very different shows, right?
Definitely, yeah.
Does everyone participate in all of them, or how does that work out? How does the work divide it up?
We all kind of support each other. I think the directors and the cast, we work, you know, we usher for a show or we box office for a show that isn't ours, and then they do the same for us.
How does that work out as a sort of an educational experience?
It's great. You know, it gives everyone involved experience not only on the stage but behind the scenes and things that they might not do otherwise.
So you're on the track to be a director, right?
I hope so.
What does that entail?
So directing for me... this is actually part of my program. I'm getting credit to direct this show, Next to Normal. And it's been a really great experience. It's given me the experience to direct a musical, which I haven't been able to do in a few years.
Mm-hmm.
So I can add that to my repertoire and my list of skills.
Where does the task of the director begin? What are the steps you have to move through?
So the task of the director, you know, in my opinion, you should spend as much time as a director working on a show before auditions that you do after auditions. You know, we've been rehearsing now for about 2 months, 8 weeks, and I've been with the script for, I think, 16 weeks, using analysis, kind of working with that, and having a foundation and a vision for the actors to come in and to feel stable to explore these characters and this rich story that we're given by Next to Normal.
You want to have made a number of decisions by the time you see your cast.
Definitely, yeah. Otherwise, you know, if there is no vision, there's no foundation, and if there's no foundation, there can be no safety and comfortability for the actors to explore.
So that's the thing that you want the actors to get from you at the beginning.
Exactly. You don't want, you know, I don't want my actors to ever feel panicked or to ever feel like I don't know what's going on.
Mm-hmm. You get turned to in a lot of different situations, right?
Always. You know, it's simple yes or no questions, or it can go all the way from, you know, what is my character doing? What is my character feeling at this point? Or to tech questions. Last night we just moved into our space at Mamiya Theater, and there were a bunch of questions about, you know, the set, the stairs, where should this be? And you're just going to have all those answers.
In terms of interpretation, once you have, now you're in phase two, you've met the actors, you've cast the show, does interpretation change based on what the actors give you?
Definitely. You know, I think a lot of the things that I had to give them, what they did is they not maybe not changed it, but they took it, and it fed them, and they ran with it. And so now what we have to show the public on Thursday is we have a collaboration. Now, it's not just my vision overarching. It's not just this is what I want to see. It's what we have worked with, what the cast has worked with, what the designers have worked with, all coming together to form some, to synergize into something much stronger and more poignant.
There seems to be a sort of a continuum of director styles from, you know, giving line readings on one end to saying you figure it out on the other.
Yeah, I would say that that's true. I've worked with many from across the spectrum, more dictatorial or more just, you know, explore, do what you want to do. I'm just here.
The explore, I'm just here thing might leave actors feeling as if they're standing up in a rubber boat, yeah?
I think it can, because they're hungry for that guidance.
Yeah. And yet want to have, they want to have their own input too, right?
It's a balancing act. Yeah. You know, like every other kind of art and every other kind of craft, it's a balancing act.
Yeah.
Can't be too hard, can't be too soft.
You know, we talked about a production of Next to Normal a couple of weeks ago on the show, and the whole thing of a musical carrying with it expectations of leaving you feeling good and dancing your way out of the theater, singing that finale song.
Mm-hmm.
Next to Normal doesn't quite work that way, does it?
It does not. In the story of Next to Normal itself, it revolves around a suburban family, specifically the mother, Diana, who's diagnosed with bipolar disorder. Mm-hmm. And the story is how her family kind of deals with the effects of her illness and how she deals with the treatments for her illness. And it just kind of, everything unravels. It gives us the opportunity to shed light on something that's not usually talked about. But because of that, you're right, it's not kind of a golden age happy musical where everyone is probably going to be really happy and dancing in the aisles to leave as they leave. It's a lot heavier, I think.
Oklahoma, it ain't, right?
It's definitely not set there, no.
But the story is largely advanced through song, which is interesting.
It is. There's actually very, very little dialogue, spoken dialogue. There's a bit in the transitions between the songs. There's a bit inside the songs. But mostly the dialogue, the message, the story is communicated through the music itself.
And it's a pretty powerful message, too. Thanks very much for coming in, Kevin.
Thank you for having me.
Kevin Berg is a guest director of Next to Normal at the Chaminade University Collegiate Theater Festival, which begins Thursday, runs through August 14th, at the Richard T. Mamiya Theater and Lou Theaters. The festival will feature three productions, Next to Normal, Almost Maine, and The Rose and Rhyme.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the law firm Alston, Hunt, Floyd, and Ng, serving clients and the community in Hawaii for a quarter century. More information online at ahfi.com.
They wanted to lock her up in Cleveland. Now it's her turn.
When you pulled back the curtain, it was just Donald Trump with nothing to offer to the American people.
Hillary Clinton lights up the city of brotherly love at the Democratic National Convention. Will it be high road or bottom-feeding insults? Next time on The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International.
This morning at 9, right after The Conversation.
Let's talk about budgets. It costs $9.15 to run Hawaii Public Radio's statewide network every minute of the day. That comes to $13,000 a day, $92,000 a week. These members understand balancing a budget. We are infinitely grateful for their support. Kanani Chung of Honolulu, Thomas Ye of Hilo, and Mark Berry and Kelly Trang of Haiku. If HPR adds quality to your life, please become a member of Hawaii Public Radio. You can find us at hawaiipublicradio.org, which is open every minute of every day. And thanks.
Support for today's programming comes from Blue Zones Project Hawaii, a community-led well-being initiative working to improve the health of Hawaii's residents. Applications for communities to participate are at beabluezones.com, brought to Hawaii by HMSA.
In the middle 1980s, Hawaiian Electric took some big risks to become more than just an electric company. Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair picks up the special series Electric Dreams and what happened when the utility's focus turned to diversification. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
HECO's growth mirrored the growth of the state, and we talked about the boom years. But what happened when HECO hit the 1980s?
There's a fellow by the name of Dudley Pratt. He was the president and CEO of HECO, and he decided to create HEI, Hawaiian Electric Industries, because he felt like the company either had to grow or die. And so diversification, in fact, became the name of the game. What it really meant was investing on things other than the electric company, the electric needs here in the islands. So you had things like money going to corporate securities, long-term investments, things like coal-burning plants in Georgia, and even beyond the U.S. shores into Asia. And it was working for a while. At one point, the stock for the company shot up 34%, and the company began buying other businesses. And that's a siren going by on YLI. Happy Monday, Beth Ann.
Yes, especially a Monday after this weekend that we had. So go ahead. So with what was happening with all the diversification, you mentioned that it worked for a while. When did it start to go sour?
Well, you could point to a couple of things. I should tell you, by 1987, peak demand for electricity, this was in a hot September day, 1 million kilowatts exceeded, first time in history. But I think that the turning point was Hurricane Aniki in September 11th, 1992. I was thinking about Aniki and Hawaiian Electric last night as the rain came down and it thundered and lightning and so forth. But what happened was Hawaiian Electric also invested in an insurance company here locally, Hawaiian Insurance Group. Well, the claims from Aniki were enormous, and the company eventually had to abandon the insurance business. It just was not something that was worthwhile for its investors. There were some people internally thinking maybe Hawaiian Electric is getting too big.
getting too big or focused on the wrong things.
Yes, exactly. And so the idea was to refocus. But there was a couple of other things that didn't go well either. Investment in Mongolia, some electrical facilities in China, and as well in the Philippines. And they were actually huge multi-million dollar losses for the company. So the focus was to refocus back here on Hawaii. But having done so, they also missed an opportunity in 2002 to pick up what eventually became the Kauai Island Utility Co-op. As you know, Hawaiian Electric has the electric facilities on all the islands except Kauai. Well, their bid fell short. So Hawaiian Electric is in a transition period, expanded to its largest size, the largest company in Hawaii, and then suddenly having, not suddenly, over a period of years, having to look and say, well, wait a minute, maybe we are going in the wrong direction.
And not paying attention to what seems to be the direction that we're in now. Lots of criticism that they just didn't see it coming early enough or were unwilling to be able to take up that line of thought and back it with action. All right, we'll pick up the story soon. Thanks very much, Chad.
Thanks, Beth Ann.
Chad Blair joins us daily from Civil Beat with a reality check.
Support for The Conversation comes from Sacred Hearts Academy, a private school for girls in grades preschool through high school, where the focus is on science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. Learn more at sacredhearts.org.
Bring your friends and ohana to HPR's annual fundraiser at the Palikū Theater on August 7th. This year featuring a world premiere double bill with Kuana Torres Kahele, and enjoy a group discount. Find out more about this limited offer at hawaiipublicradio.org/events. And please plan on joining us between shows for a mini luau, lei-making demonstration, and good conversation. And make your group reservation today.
Tonight at 5, it's The Body Show with Dr. Kathy Kozak. And Kathy, sometimes when a patient hears the word cancer, that's pretty much the last word they understand in the whole visit, isn't it?
Well, absolutely, because, you know, you never expect or you hope you don't hear that word. And then once you do, it's like everything else just sounds muted. You just don't hear it all. And I think that just has a lot to do with the fact that, you know, these days people really are afraid of cancer because we think chemotherapy and we think radiation and hair loss and all these sorts of things. But today we're going to talk about, where does immunotherapy, this is a new branch of cancer treatment that has really made a huge surge in how we address people's cancers. And yes, cancer is a scary word, but let's talk about some of the newer treatments and really try and help allay people's fears about what treatment really could be like.
Kathy, what's different about immunotherapy?
You know, we're starting to make cancer treatment personal to the tumor. So we're finding that there are some unique genetic elements that have to do with cancers in different parts of the body. And if you target that gene, then you can actually treat, in some cases, a colon cancer, like a thyroid cancer, like a breast cancer, because it's a genetic mutation. So we're starting to figure out exactly what's going on with the tumor rather than just trying to treat everybody with similar medication. It's really personalizing cancer care.
So it doesn't necessarily lead to chemo, is what you're saying.
Not all cancers lead to traditional chemotherapy. There's a lot of options out there, and we're going to discuss what that is and make sure people understand how to know if they're getting the best, latest, and greatest treatment.
In general, across the board, Kathy, aren't recovery rates getting better all the time?
Well, they are. We'll talk more about it this afternoon.
Sounds good, Kathy. Thanks a lot. That's The Body Show with Dr. Kathy Kozak tonight at 5.
In a few weeks, voters will make their choices in Hawaii's primary. With the state House seats up for election, along with many county council seats, some of the contests could bring power shifts, including on Maui. We called a longtime resident and community activist who spent most of the past 5 decades involved in the planning of Maui County. Dick Mayer is on the line with some of the contests he's watching and why. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
Good to talk to you. Let's start taking a first look at some of the House races. In particular, the ones in District 11 and 12. What's so special about those?
Well, District 11 is South Maui, Kihei, McKenna, Wailea. In that race, we have an incumbent, a very young man who's been in already 4 years. He was former student body president at Manoa. His name is Kaniela Ng. And he's been in, and he's been, I would say, in the political spectrum, a liberal. He supported Bernie Sanders. He also was active in the environmental area with the anti-GMO issue. And he has a contest against a very formidable candidate, Deidre Teagarden. Deidre has worked on Maui in a number of capacities in the nonprofit sector. She also was a director for one of the county's departments, and then went off to the state legislature. Not state legislature. Went off to the governor's office and worked at first as his representative, Governor Abercrombie, and then as his protocol officer. So she's had a number of experiences, and she's come back, and she's challenging him with a lot of financial support. She's getting some large contributions from a number of construction unions and sort of the establishment types. So we have here a candidate who's young, 27-year-old Kaniela Ng, against a person who's trying to challenge him, who's a 47-year-old Deidre Teagarden.
Dick, as you look at those two candidates, though, it seems as if Kaniela Ng is very much sort of the poster child for the new engaged voter, given the fact that he seems to be reasonably, as you mentioned, anti-establishment, but also anti-GMO, and that's been such a defining line for where people sit, is it not?
Exactly right. And it is an interesting case. He's almost like jumped the gun. He's one of the early people, early young people, to really get involved, and not only get involved, but actually get into the legislature. And he is, in many ways, a poster child for that that effort by young people to get involved, who now realize that their future is ahead of them and they better take control of it if they want to keep the establishment, the people who have messed things up, from doing even worse.
But you say that he has a really formidable challenger in Deidre Teagarden.
Exactly, and she's competing very hard, giving him a tough race, and I would say it's really a toss-up at this point as to who's going to win that. Usually we assume incumbents are going to win. I don't think we can make that assumption in this case here. She's mounting a very, very organized campaign going throughout the district and having lots of signs up, lots of money, very high amount. I think the Maui News said she has received the highest amount of funding of any of the candidates on Maui, local or state. Good race.
Let's for a moment take a look now at the District 12, the upcountry race, with Carl Yamashita's seat.
Right. That we have almost the opposite. We have here a long-established person, older person, Carl Yamashita, who's been in office now for 12 years. He's gotten onto the Finance Committee, and he has had almost no opposition for the past 12 years. Each time he runs, there's been generally a weak or lowly funded candidate running against him, and he's generally cruised into office without any real challenges. This year, he does face a real challenge. Again, a young lady who got inspired working on some local community issues, the opposition to Oluwalu development, the telescope on top of Haleakala, the GMO issue, etc. Tiare Lawrence. Tiare Lawrence is a young businesswoman who is challenging him, getting good funding, getting lots of support from a lot of not only young people, but I think some of the older people as well. And I think she's going to give Kaya Mashita quite a race.
It seems that, as you say, this is the inverse of what we just talked about a moment ago with District 11. But you would think, from having looked at the situation, perhaps that it would be more, kind of riding some coattails there if this is the movement where you have sort of generational divides. Is that really happening, or only showing up pretty much in these two races?
Right now, it's so exemplified in these two races. There are other challenges, as there always are in races, where incumbents are challenged by somebody. But these are two races where we have a dichotomy, and it's not just the funding. We have the establishment candidates. In one race, it's the incumbent. In another race, it's the challenger. And we have two younger people who are, one is the incumbent and one is, again, is the challenger. And I think it's an age difference between the two. The younger ones are probably on the more liberal side of the spectrum, more environmentally concerned, thinking of housing and the difficulty of young families to get established. And then we have the older candidates, Kyle Yamashita and Deidre Teagarden, who are representing some well-funded groups, have large contributions coming in from construction unions, and et cetera. So,
Dick, in the interest of time, I want to just move along and ask you about some of the Maui Council seats. You've got two out of the four that are up, that are termed out, and the other two, which may see some people unseated. Which ones are you watching and why?
Well, there are only four primary races this year, and two of them have incumbents, incumbents who have termed out. And in both races, we have many, many candidates. The upcountry race has four candidates. That's Gladys Bice's seat. And in the Wailuku area, Mike Victorino has five people trying to get his position. And in each race, there's a story behind each of the candidates vying for those positions. In the other two races that we don't have people terming out, we have challengers to the incumbents. And one of them is particularly heated, and that's the South Maui race, where Don Couch, the present incumbent, is being challenged by Kelly King, former member of the State Board of Education, and well-known on the island as a businesswoman. She and her husband set up and established Pacific Biodiesel Company, which has now gone statewide and even on the mainland. And they've been young entrepreneurs, and she's the marketing manager for that. And so she's challenging, and she's doing very well, I think. And it's what's interesting is it's a countywide race. On Maui, it's usually very difficult for a non-incumbent to win because they have to go and advertise countywide, get known on Lanai, Molokai, all the remote areas. And in this case, Kelly King, I think, will give Don Couch a very tough race.
And also seemingly be back in that same mode that you cast a little earlier of a generational divide. I wish we had more time to talk about this, but very briefly, the upcountry seat?
What about it? Oh, the upcountry seat is... got four candidates, Yukile Sugimura, who's been a community organizer for a long time, being challenged by Stacey Moniz, head of the nonprofit Women Helping Women, and also Napua Greek Nakasone, who comes from a family with long political legacy, and she's also very active in the Hawaiian community, challenging her. And then there's a fourth candidate, a man, Eric Molina, who's not run a very active campaign so far, and he's got a name, though, that's highly recognized for 50 years on Maui as a political family, the Molina family.
All right, we're going to leave it there for the moment, but some interesting races for us to be watching, and we will. Thanks very much for the overview.
Thank you, and have a lovely day.
You too. Dick Mayer has lived on Maui for five decades and has been active in environmental issues and in Maui's efforts to plan its future. He taught economics and geography at Maui Community College and now coordinates the Alliance of Maui Community Associations.
In today's backyard quiz, Hawaii Five-O Steve McGarrett always seems to get his man, with the exception of this guy, a master criminal in the mold of Fu Manchu, our Professor Moriarty. He was in dozens of episodes of the show's original run on CBS from 1968 to 1980. He was caught in that show's very last episode, but the writers dropped hint that he would escape yet again. The actor who played him, born Kenneth Dickerson, was of mixed English, Egyptian, and Sudanese ancestry, but gave a convincing impersonation of a Chinese super spy. Because every hero needs a villain to test his mettle, the producers of the new edition of Hawaii Five-O have revived the character, who remains tantalizingly just out of McGarrett's reach. He's still got the same name, a name the show's originator, Leonard Freeman, took from a popular restaurant in Honolulu's Chinatown, Woe Fats. That's the name of our master criminal and the name we're looking for today.
And it's the name that Philip Kikukawa knew. He called in and will be getting the HPR t-shirt. Thanks very much for playing the backyard quiz. And if you've got a question for us, you can always send it in to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Stargazer Time, our weekly look into the massive universe around our extraordinarily small planet, and also what to look for in our dark island skies. As usual, we turn to the expertise of Christopher Phillips, and we welcome him back now. Hey, Christopher, how's it going? What do you have this week?
Hey, Dave. It's good to be here. So this week, we have Venus, Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn. Look for them in an arc from east to west after sunset. The moon this week will begin to wane, meaning we will see a gradual return to darker skies as the week goes on.
I understand that you have information this week on a distant galaxy cluster.
I do indeed. The Hubble Space Telescope has detected a cluster of galaxies known as Abel S1063. They are so distant that not only is Hubble peering into deep space, but it is also looking back through time, around 4 billion years ago.
Each of these galaxies contains just a huge number of planets and stuff, stars, right?
Hundreds of billions of stars and probably countless planets.
And the part of it that's even more startling to understand is looking back through time the way you were describing. Can you provide some insight into that?
Well, the universe is vast, and the light from objects very far away can take billions of years to reach us. And so when we see them, they appear to us as they were billions of years ago. Our nearest neighbor star, for example, is Alpha Centauri, and it's around 4.3 light years away. This means that the light from that star has taken over 4 years to reach our eyes here on planet Earth.
And these very hard to understand calculations work when it comes to the sun too, right?
They do indeed. In fact, the sun is so far away from the Earth that its light takes around 8 minutes to travel through space to reach us.
But you're seeing it a lot more currently than these distant galaxy clusters light.
Absolutely.
And what else can you tell us about this new discovery?
Well, this galaxy cluster is very important because by observing it, we are able to make predictions about the presence of dark matter and to study the effects that gravity has on light. It's a phenomenon called gravitational microlensing. When light passes near a massive object like a star or a galaxy, it bends. And so watching these galaxies allows us to understand how that all works.
That is very intense stuff, and thankfully we have you to help us figure it out. It's Christopher Phillips and another Stargazer report here. Thank you very much.
You are welcome, Dave.
And I'm Dave Lawrence. We will catch you next week.
Support for Stargazer comes from Ferraro Choi, providing environmentally sustainable architecture, interior design, and research for projects throughout Hawaii and the Pacific. FerraroChoi.com.
Children find it easy to leap into fantastical new worlds, and we can only envy them. Adults who are able to create such worlds and bring them to life in performance have a special gift and a special skill. Peter Wing and his wife Melinda Wing have made storytelling to children a specialty. They're presenting a show called Mythical Magical Creatures, Stories and Songs at the Kihei Public Library later this week, and Peter's on the line. Good morning.
Aloha. How are you?
All right. I sort of envy you your job getting to live in the mind of children.
Well, I've never left it.
Which is the secret, right?
Yeah, exactly. I ran my own preschool for 40 years, and my wife, Melinda, was a children's librarian, and so we've been telling stories together for, 30, 35 years, and it's a passion. We just love it, and I think that's contagious when we tell.
What is it about the child's mind, Peter?
Well, that it's ready to believe. And I think that actually our programs are geared not only to children, but to families, including children of all ages. And I think storytelling is really invites a suspension of belief.
Mm-hmm.
And it lets us actually see beyond our smaller discursive minds to a much bigger cosmos, and all people of all cultures have an intrinsic desire to do storytelling, and we really are trying to keep this alive and vibrant as an art.
Well, you refer to the smaller discursive mind, and I agree with that characterization, but it's troubling to me that the mind should get smaller, yeah?
Yeah. I think we have...
It's not what we're supposed to be doing.
Really? Well, I think we have no trouble at the beginning and usually no trouble at the end. It's just a lot of time in the middle we get confused by things.
Yeah, I'm squarely in that middle now. I think a lot of us are. So how do we free ourselves, you know, if you get caught up in being an adult?
Well, I think that one of the principal uses of storytelling is for a cathartic experience, and drama, and particularly with oral stories, really invite a personal connection and really being able to envision and see something bigger than what we are normally seeing. And so consequently, in our storytelling, we like to do lots of drama, skits, music, and really weave that all together into something that is engaging, not only for the children, but for the adults as well.
You know, when you talk about the willingness to believe in children, in a way, that really sort of paves the way for a storyteller, because they buy in very readily into an entirely new world, don't they?
Yes, they certainly do. And one thing that I found through my years of teaching is giving children raw materials and letting them follow their innate curiosity, they can get to places that we can't. Would never have guessed, and it's always been like that, and very, very pleased to remind children that they can do that.
Because of fewer barriers in their thinking?
Yeah, I think children have to learn to be self-limiting, and unfortunately that happens a great deal in our educational system and society, and sometimes we have to work to keep options open for them.
It does seem as if, I think that's probably an accurate depiction, but it does seem as if it's working exactly opposite from how it should, doesn't it?
Yeah. Although, you know, if I didn't have contact with children, I would really be an old curmudgeon by this point, and I can't be when I relate with children, and I just have a natural hope for the future. They really have that spark that every new generation has to keep the world new.
That cranky old curmudgeon thing is an aspect of adulthood that children really don't understand or relate to terribly well, isn't it?
Well, again, in storytelling, I think sometimes we portray characters like that.
Sure.
Children have no difficulty pegging, I see what that one is.
Scrooge or whoever.
Yeah, sure.
Right. Well, what are some of the stories that you know are going to connect with kids that are very young?
Well, we do a collection. We, of course, take from all over the world for folk tales. We also write some of our own stories. And then one thing I like to do in every program is to retell a traditional Hawaiian story, which I take some liberty with to retell it in our own fashion with a lot of humor and drama and get the children to participate. And I feel like that doesn't step on any toes and that it really helps the children become familiar with some of the themes of traditional stories here.
Well, Peter, when you take liberties with a story, you're pretty much doing what every storyteller has done since the dawn of time, right?
Well, there's one aspect to Hawaiian stories of being articulate and telling. It's like traditional hula. You don't make up traditional hula, but you can make up awana hula, and that's what we do.
No, that's a good distinction, Peter. I see what you mean. Thanks very much for talking with us this morning.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thank you.
You bet. Peter and Melinda Wing will present Mythical Magical Creatures, Stories and Songs at the Kihei Public Library this Wednesday, July 27th. It's at 3 p.m. and it's free of charge.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the National Kidney Foundation of Hawaii, striving to increase awareness and treatment of kidney diseases affecting 1 in 7 Hawaii residents. Learn more at kidneyhi.org.
NPR News asked Americans how their lives have changed in 8 years. Then we asked the man who's been president for those years.
I've been frustrated by some things that I did not complete, that I couldn't wrap and mail and ship before I got out of here.
I'm Steve Inskeep. What President Obama wishes he could have done in part two of our documentary on Obama's years.
Tuesday evening at 7.
Beth Ann, it used to be unthinkable for a local candidate of either party to repudiate its party's national presidential nominee. We're seeing it on both sides this year, aren't we?
We're seeing a lot of it, and a lot of splits, and a lot of questions about where the parties are going to go from here. This is not a case where it's going to be easy to kiss and make up, or even just make up. And talking to Beth Fukumoto Chang over time, as we've been doing for now quite a while, and hearing the evolution of her own thoughts about her party in Hawaii, what that party may be able to do or not do, and whether or not she will be able to stay in it is just a lot of ongoing query.
And now as the Democratic Convention unfolds, we're seeing it unravel. What a summer.
What a summer. And just to remind you that we're going to have special coverage for you at 2 o'clock on HPR2 to be able to listen to the conventions this week. Also at 4 o'clock on HPR1. So we hope you'll plan to tune in and get some live coverage. We are going to go away for the moment, but we'll be back with you live tomorrow morning. And you know that by law, the State Department of Health is supposed to be posting its long-term care facility inspection reports, but it hasn't been doing that, and that's why Kukua Council says it will file suit. And we'll talk to Larry Geller of Kukua Council tomorrow.
And we'll hear from surf photographer Zach Noyle, who let us in on some of his secrets.
If you'd like to be in touch with us, call our talkback line. It's 808-792-8217. Or you can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Find podcasts of past shows on the Conversation page under Talk Shows for the Conversation on hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Chris Vandercook.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. We'll see you in the morning right here for more of the Conversation.